1 Samuel chapter 28. In due time, the Philistines assembled their armies for war against Israel. Achish told David, "You know, of course, that you and your men will join me and the army in battle." David answered Achish, "I see that you already know what your servant will do." Achish said to David, "For that answer, I am making you my personal bodyguard for life." Now Samuel was dead. All Israel had mourned him and buried him in his city, Ramah. Also, Shaul had expelled from the land those who tell the future by communicating with the dead or with a demonic spirit. The Philistines assembled, and then they went and pitched camp at Shunem, while Shaul gathered all Israel together and pitched camp at Gilboa. When Shaul saw the army of the Philistines, he became afraid. It struck terror in his heart. But when he consulted Yahweh, Yahweh didn't answer him, not by dreams, not by Urim, and not by prophets. Then Shaul said to his servants, "Try to find a woman who tells the future by communicating with the dead. I want to go and consult with her." His servants answered him, "Yes, there's a woman in Endor who tells the future by communicating with the dead." So Shaul disguised himself by wearing different clothing, went with two men, and came to the woman by night and said, "Tell me the future, please. Bring up from the dead the person I name to you." The woman answered, "Here you know what Shaul did, how he expelled from the land those who tell the future by communicating with the dead or with a demonic spirit. Why are you trying to entrap me into causing my own death?" But Shaul swore to her by Adonai, "As Adonai lives, you will not be punished for doing this." Then the woman asked, "Whom should I bring up for you?" He said, "Bring up for me Samuel." When the woman saw Samuel, she let out a shriek. And then the woman said to Shaul, "Why have you deceived me? You yourself are Shaul." The king replied, "Don't be afraid. Just tell me what you see." The woman said to Shaul, "I see a godlike being coming up out of the earth." He asked her, "What does he look like?" She said, "An old man is coming up. He's wearing a cloak." Shaul realized it was Samuel, so he bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself. Samuel asked Shaul, "Why have you disturbed me and brought me up?" Shaul answered, "I'm very upset because the Philistines are making war against me and God has left me and doesn't answer me anymore, neither by prophets nor by dreams. This is why I've called you, so that you can let me know what to do." Samuel said, "Why ask me? If Adonai has left you and become your enemy, Adonai has done for himself what he foretold through me. Adonai has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to your fellow countryman, David, because you didn't obey what Adonai said and execute his furious anger toward Amalek. That's why Adonai is doing this to you today. Adonai is giving Israel, as well as yourself, over into the power of the Philistines. And tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. Adonai will hand over Israel's army to the power of the Philistines." Shaul immediately fell full length on the ground and became terribly frightened because of what Samuel had said. He had no strength left in him, for he had eaten nothing all that day and night. The woman approached Shaul, saw that he was panic-stricken, and said to him, "Here, your servant listened to what you said. I put my life in my hands and did what you requested me to do. Now, therefore, please, you listen to what your servant says. Let me put a little food in front of you, then eat, so you will have some strength when you go on your way." But he refused and said, "I won't eat." Then his servants, together with the woman, urged him, and he heeded what they said. He got up off the ground and sat on the bed. The woman had a fattened calf in the house. She hurried to slaughter it. Then she took flour, kneaded it, and baked matzah with it. She served it to Shaul and his servants, and they ate. Afterwards, they got up and they went away that night. Chapter 29. The Philistines gathered all their army together at Aphek, while Israel's army pitched camp by the spring in Israel. The leaders of the Philistines were passing by with their hundreds and thousands. David and his men were bringing up the rear with Achish. The chiefs of the Philistines asked, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" Achish answered the chiefs of the Philistines, "This is David, who was a servant of Shaul, king of Israel. He's been with me now for well over a year, and I haven't found anything wrong with him between the time he deserted to me and now." But the chiefs of the Philistines became angry and said to him, "Have the man return and go back to the place you set aside for him. Don't let him go into battle with us, because on the battlefield he might become our enemy. What better way could there be for him to get reconciled with his Lord than by cutting off the heads of our men? This is David. They used to dance and sing about him. Shaul killed his thousands, but David his tens of thousands." So Achish summoned David and said to him, "As Adonai lives, you have been upright, and I myself would be more than pleased to have you go on campaign with me, because I haven't found anything wrong with you between the day you arrived and now. However, the chiefs don't trust you. Therefore, now go on back and go in peace, so as not to do what appears bad to the chiefs of the Philistines." David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant during the time I've been with you that disqualifies me from going and fighting against the enemies of my lord the king?" Achish answered David, "I know that you are as good from my point of view as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the chiefs of the Philistines have said he is not to go up with us to the battlefield. So get up early in the morning with the servants of your lord who came with you, and as soon as you are up and gets light, leave." David got up early in the morning, he and his men, to leave and go back into the land of the Philistines, while the Philistines continued up to Israel.
That was 1 Samuel chapter 28 and 29. I realize we're not going to be actually talking about both chapters necessarily today, but I need them both read together because they kind of all jumble up. The 28, 29, 30, 31, to divide them all up is not quite that convenient because they kind of answer each other's questions a few times. So first of all, first chapter 28, I go through my little hodgepodge notes here. Any questions or comments regarding 1 Samuel chapter 28? This is the Saul's encounter with a particular individual lady who conjures up Samuel. I know it's a fairly heavily studied chapter. Yes, William.
Yes, it's interesting that Yeshua said that if there was no other way to come into that world, but if you come up another way, you are a thief and you are a robber. And this is what Saul did. He went into that realm another way. And just the fact that that lady was able to bring him or engage that world lets us know that that is real. It can take place. But Yeshua said, if you come up another way, you are a thief and you are a robber if you come up another way. And that's what Shaul did. And that was just interesting that he decided to come up the other way to bring forth Samuel. And Samuel didn't ask why the woman brought him forth. He said, "Why have you brought me forth?" So that was pretty interesting.
He knew who was responsible for it. There are a couple of you had their hands up.
From my understanding, the vision of Samuel is actually not... It's probably an impersonation of Samuel by demons.
Mm-hmm.
And because Saul was so desperate, he would try anything, and he did the wrong thing.
No argument. He actually did, in fact, the wrong thing. He was very desperate. I have no argument with this. We'll discuss what this being is, or what it is, what it could be, in a few moments. Yes, Jeff.
Well, could this also be kind of a similar situation to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, trying to find knowledge apart from God from some other avenue, and the paucity of that approach?
That's actually a good way of looking at it. That's a good point. One could argue that too. There is, put it this way, I have no doubt in my mind that something actually did occur. I believe that's actually true. It's not that this was just, you know, something made up the story, or that this medium or necromancer, whatever you wish to call her, didn't actually do anything. And I actually think there was something there.
I say it's forbidden in Torah.
Right. Therefore, it must exist if it's
right.
Explicitly forbidden. You don't forbid something that doesn't exist. Like, I don't forbid that you shall not breathe water. Okay, if you really want to do it, it's your business. But honestly, something that doesn't happen, it would make any sense.
To forbid it.
Why bother forbidding something that couldn't happen? So I believe something actually can, in fact, happen. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Ellie.
Well, it's just the scripture that in Psalms that says in the grave there is no thought and there is no thinkings, there's nothing. And the book of Job that says, hey, God, don't forget to wake me up, implies that you can't bring somebody back from the dead.
We'll discuss that. The reason I will discuss, just briefly, at this point, you have to ask yourself a question. Is Samuel actually dead? Yes, his body's dead. But because we know that there are examples of the Bible, people being raised from the dead, they still have the last memories, typically, or it's believed to be that we had the last memories when they died, then the person himself can, in fact, be raised back from the dead to do something for however long. I mean, Lazarus obviously was an example. We have Elisha, and Elijah obviously raised people from the dead. Being raised from the dead is not an unheard-of instance. So that can happen. Now, what does that mean? Well, we'll hopefully get a chance to discuss that and won't step on any toes in the process. Any other comments or questions regarding this? Okay. I know this is a fairly well-studied chapter because people wish to always look at it. Oh, yes, Mary.
I was a little slow on the draw.
That's okay.
Did somebody already say this? Was Samuel in a holding place, like the Abraham's bosom, or paradise, or however you want to say that?
You know, I know that's a common belief both in Judaism as well as many Christian organizations. I don't think I can answer that very well, because my personal opinion would get in the way. So I'm going to have to stay with that. I don't know what goes on after I'm dead. I mean, physically, I mean, I know the concept. Okay, yeah, you're dead, you're buried, God, resurrection. I understand that process. But what actually happens in there, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I can tell, you're asleep. But that doesn't mean that I'm right. So I can't answer that question very well, now without getting my own personal opinion in it.
What I learned in Christianity was that it was a demonic spirit, familiar spirit. That's what I was told.
That's common in most Christian groups. This is a demon. That's very, very, very common. Because it explains away all the questions. Just say it was a demon, okay, let's move on. It's a very simple way of looking at it. Not that it's wrong, it's just that it's a simple way of explaining it away. Judaism doesn't take such a simple view of it. Simple meaning, not quite that. Not that it's wrong, it's that it's incorrect, just that it's not quite that simple necessarily, because of certain events that occur during this encounter, as far as what demons do and don't do versus what other spirits do. Any other comments?
It's kind of a long shot. It just makes me think of like one of the parables that Yeshua talked about, the rich man and Lazarus, I believe.
Right.
How, you know, Lazarus was a man of suffering on the earth, and the rich man lived, you know, very easily and everything. And And then he was suffering, you know, they both died or whatever, and then he was suffering, the rich man, and then Lazarus was being comforted.
Right.
In, right. I thought, paradise or some place, well, yeah, right, I forget right, what it was right, called.
Right. With Abraham.
Abraham's bosom, bosom
right.
or something like that. So right. I don't know if that sheds light or whatever. I mean, maybe.
It's interesting. It's a parable, of course, being given, naturally, but there are... Talking about spiritual ideas and spiritual events are a very difficult topic, and they're very hot button because most of us have our own package and we say, this is what it is. And like, you know what? That's great for you personally, but reality is, whatever you have, there's extremely high chance it's probably wrong, including my own. it's just track records seem to show that. So we'll discuss it a little bit, but I'm gonna have to get a few of the things ahead of time done first before I get there. I'm going to back up a little bit earlier in the chapter, because obviously this one's going to take, I'm guessing, quite a while to discuss that topic. Verse 1. It says, having those days, of course, Philistines gather armies together to go to war with Israel. They, of course, invite David, say, oh, yes, you will come with us. Now, we know from the previous chapters, David was very successful in convincing Achish, the king of Gath, which I map here, king of Gath, that he was on his side, battling the Israelites, you know, raiding small towns here and there, killing people, doing whatever he could. Of course, David was blatantly lying to Achish. He was actually living in Ziklag, according to rules, but he was attacking Amalek and the other Canaanite peoples, the enemies of Israel. But since he would leave no one alive, there was no identifier marker that said who he actually killed, and no one could say, well, David attacked our town. No, he attacked our town. Nothing that happened because no one knew. But it was brought up last week, last 2 weeks ago, but which I did not answer very well at the time. I realized that Bill is gone now. He's the one who brought it up. But he had pointed out that, well, was David right in killing off these people, man, woman, child, leaving no one alive? And I discussed, well, these are enemies of God, and God had declared these enemies need to be expelled or gotten rid of. At one point or another, he had asked them. He had commanded all Israel to do that. And Bill brought up the question, well, yes, but he commanded them previously. Like, for example, he commanded in Moses' time, when you go in the land, you will conquer and push out the Canaanites. But that was 400 plus years earlier than this. And also commanded in Joshua's time to do the same, but that was 370 some odd years earlier than this. And of course commanded Saul to kill Amalek, and that was a debatable 2 to 10 years earlier than this. But, and Bill had pointed out, that when God tells you to do something at one moment in time, that doesn't necessarily mean that it must be done in the future, but rather be done then. And he cited the example of Moses and the spies being sent out to spy out the land. They came back with a bad report, convinced people not to go. And they said, okay, we're not going to go. And then God said, okay, you're not going to get it for 40 years. Said, oh, no, no, we'll go. But it was too late. God had already rescinded the order. What I did not answer sufficiently, I don't feel, is that how is it that these examples of David doing this to Canaanites and Amalek different than the scenario given to Moses and the spies and the people of Israel and to Joshua? Well, the difference is, the rule given to Moses and the spies was rescinded by God. God told them, no, you will not go now. Versus the law that God gave to, or the rules God gave to Joshua and Saul were never rescinded. God didn't say, you will do this now and then later, okay, stop. There was never an okay, stop. It was that you will take it and you will continue and expel the people out until there is nothing left. That was the order God gave. And he said it would take them many generations to do so. It wasn't going to be an instantaneous event. So David's going after Israelites' enemies, Amalek, and of course the Canaanites, that was still an acceptable, in my mind, event. That he was not doing anything evil or ungodly at the time. But I wanted to point that out because I did not sufficiently answer it 2 weeks ago. Okay, let's continue on now. Now that that's out of the way. Oh, any questions or comments about that? Yes, Carrie.
I'm drawing a little bit of a blank, but even on surface, those two situations do seem very different. I mean, going into the land wasn't necessarily God staying their God or not being their God anymore. Whereas when he told the Israelites to expel those peoples, he gave a very specific reason, It was, because if they allowed them to continue living there, they would choose other gods.
Right. We have to continue Thor on their side. Which is, yes, exactly. There are distinct differences, but I wanted to address that. Okay, so now let's go in and go into the chapter, because I've got to fly through this until I get to the one event that we all want to talk about. So of course he offers to David, you will go with me, of course. And David says, oh, sure, yeah, you know, I'll do it. Do you really believe David was actually intending to go fight against Israel? The vast majority of us would say, of course not. He's not going to fight against Israel. This is David and his men. There's a high probability David's lying to Achish right here, saying that, oh, you will see what your servant will do, being very ambiguous on purpose. What would that mean? Well, if David happened to be Achish's bodyguard in the rear of the camp, the most convenient place to do a rear assault, he's a perfect scenario. The problem would be, in God's plan, is if God allowed this to occur to David, and David was allowed to go into battle with the Philistines on the Philistine side, and since it clearly is, we already know, God's intention to have Saul and his sons killed, it would be near impossible to convince the rest of Israel that David did not have a hand in the death of Saul. Nearly impossible. Now, one could argue, well, you could, you know, somehow convince a small group of people that he didn't. Yeah, you're right. You could convince a small group of people. But not everybody, because everybody needs him as a king. So it would not be in God's plan that this actually happened, of course, which is why I had read, or had Joshua read chapter 29 as well, that David's being told to go back. Because it was not in God's plan for him to be a part of this particular battle. So, of course, we'll continue on. Verse 3. We already know Samuel's dead. Samuel died a few chapters ago. They mentioned that. Well, they had to reset the stage again. By the way, remember, everybody, Samuel's dead, so this is a scenario that's occurring. This is not very long after he had died. Some guesstimate about a year or so after he died, roughly. Not a dead exact. It might be a year and a half, hard to say for sure. But they're about that time period. Of course, they all limited it, but it points out here that Saul had put away all the mediums or the spirits or necromancers out of the land. And that is the rule, the order he sent forth. For his benefit or detriment, however you wish to argue it, it didn't get fulfilled because the Lady of Endor was still around. He goes up, says, the Philistines gathered and camped at Shushanim. So Saul gathered Israel and they camped at Gilboa. Where is Shushanim? I didn't actually write Shushanim down, but it's actually a region, not a city. This is the wrong kind of pen. It's over along the northern part of Philistine territory, inching into Israel. That's the area it is. Now, where in that area? Hard to say. That's about 15 miles or so across. It could be anywhere in that region. Israel's army goes up to Mount Gilboa, which is way up here. Saul goes up to Mount Gilboa and sees the Philistine army. I have never been to Mount Gilboa. I don't know if any of you have. I don't know how far you can see, but you have to be able to see at least 40 miles from this in order to see the Philistine army, which is approaching Aphek. I have no idea. I've never been to Mount... Has anybody here been to Mount Gilboa? Can you see 40 miles? Do you recall? No? Maybe? I don't know. No, you cannot? Yes, it'd be borderline the West Bank, part of the parts of the West Bank. You can't see that far? Okay. That was a curiosity of mine, because no one's told me how he was able to see that far. I was like, oh, this is quite unique. I'm not sure how Saul was able to see the Philistine army that far away. Yeah, binoculars, quite a very clear day, I'm not sure. No, it actually points out Mount Gilboa and Gilboa, because he goes with the Lady of Endor, and they fight in Jezreel. This is the exact same region. That's pretty much where, and of course they die on Gilboa. That's where the battle takes place. The Philistines are here, they're going to come to Aphek, which is right about chapter 29. David is told to leave when they're in Aphek. Aphek is 30 miles from Mount Gilboa. And this is about 35, 40 roughly. Because Aphek is 50 miles from Ziklag, which is where David lives. I don't know how he saw. I don't know what he saw. It's a little bit difficult for me to determine, but I can tell you this much. It had to be a fairly large army. Yes, Ellie.
They were coming from the north, and he sees
Israel,
them coming from Mount
all
Gilboa.
All of Israel's army is up here in the valley of Megiddo, the Jezreel Valley.
Yeah, which is a huge valley that you could see all
you
of them.
You could see in the valley, yes.
Because that's huge.
That's a huge valley. We're not discussing in the valley. We're talking about over the valley on the
or
other side.
Behind.
Where there's mountains along here.
How funny.
I don't know how we saw them. That's the thing that floors me. How could, I mean, the Mount Gilboa is not that tall of a mountain that I can understand. Yes, Pat.
When he said he saw, is he actually referring to he became aware of? Just like we say we see things when it's a term that we use that doesn't mean we see them with our vision.
Right. That could be, but since all of Israel's army was already gathered there, my guess is he was already aware of this long before.
But didn't he have spies? He probably had people that knew where they were.
That's possible. Maybe it's referring to spies knowing, hey, this is where they're at. Hard to say. I don't have a good answer as to how he saw that far of a distance.
Maybe they pitched and then moved north.
They do move north, but not until the following day after he visits the Lady of Endor.
Oh, yeah.
So that's it's like, huh. Oh, well. It's a minor point. I'm not going to argue that, you know, thus it didn't happen. It just seems really interesting to me that had to be fantastic eyesight. Yes, William.
Yeah, when you look up that word see in the Hebrew, it does give some other
definitions or ideas behind it.
Right.
Yeah, and it's possible.
Right. So, I mean, it does give the word perceive, awareness, and some other things. So I guess if you put that in there, then that can explain it. Otherwise, no, there is no explanation for somebody being able to see 40 miles, nonetheless.
Yeah. It's possible. It's a little difficult. I don't have a good answer for it.
It could be. He's right. It could be constructed and when Saul
considered
the Philistines.
That's possible.
Yeah.
And that would make a little bit more sense as to what was happening. He wouldn't necessarily have to physically see them as opposed to his spies just telling him what side they happened to be and saying, okay, how are we going to do this? Yes, Carmel.
I volunteered to go over and check it out.
Yeah, on whose paycheck? Yes, Joshua.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because, you know, I've been up to Pikes Peak, and that's only like 14,000 feet high. Yeah. And I've seen out there probably 30 plus miles.
Yeah.
But there's no way, even if there was an army over there 40 miles, I couldn't recognize it.
What it was. I would think it would be rather difficult to identify. But yeah, that's okay. And I'm not going to argue that he had to physically. It's just some interesting wording. And it could be that it was that his spies were considering it or contemplating it, and he was understanding the size of the battle he was up against. So he sees this army, or understands this army. Of course, he trembles greatly in his heart. He asks of God, and God doesn't answer. Yeah, that's an empty feeling. God's not with you. He asks God himself. Of course, God usually spoke to Saul privately in dreams or various visions. And Saul didn't get an answer. He asks via prophets. Most likely these prophets were probably educated along the lines of Samuel's education, meaning had some other prophet teaching them how to be prophets. Still no answer. And of course, Saul still has an ephod, which with an Urim and Thummim with it, consults the priesthood. Still no answer. This is where religions intermix, as far as difference of opinion. Some give Saul a pass on this next act. Some claim this is the pinnacle of evilness. Depends on your perspective. Some give him a pass because they say, well, okay, he was king. He was trying to look out for his men, his soldiers, and he needed some guidance. Since God was not willing to give him the guidance, he opted to find some other method to get guidance to save his men's lives.
Could be king.
Could be king. I'm sorry, hold on a minute. What was that?
That would stick. First of all, he sinned by against Torah by consulting her. Second of all, thou shalt not suffer a witch or a wizard or a necromancer to live.
Right.
So he broke two.
He broke two of them. Yep. A couple things here. He actually then swore in God's name that she would not be punished for. Okay, you're in three there. three strikes, you're out. How that work? Yes.
He's certainly keeping. He's piling it on.
Yes.
But the interesting thing, though, is that when it says here that Saul had previously driven out the wizards or necromancers,
right,
whatever that phrase is there,
right,
I would submit to you, obviously he didn't drive them all out, number one.
Clearly.
But I would say that maybe the people he did drive out, mm-hmm, were the imposters, because you're not going to die for a lie.
Typically, that's true.
So the only people that would have still been around after Saul made this effort and, you know, run all these people out would have been the charlatans and the fakes. Those people who actually did communicate with spirits for real,
mm-hmm,
and had personal experiences with those spirits, they just went underground like she did.
Well, I'm sure you're absolutely right. You're right. The average typical person does not live for, or does not die for a lie. If they know they're lying, they're not usually doing it that way. Rare occasion you run across some nut job, but that doesn't happen too often. So yeah, you think you're probably right. Because she was trying to conceal herself when he came. Hey, you're trying to entrap me. I'm not going to do this. You're trying. You know that there's rules against me. Once I do anything, it's obviously I'm guilty and you're going to turn me over and kill me. So she knows. She's in hiding. It also brings to question, how loyal were Saul's servants if they knew who she was, and he's the one who declared the order of getting rid of her? And I was like, huh. Kind of makes you curious about that one, but however they knew her, they happened to have known her. of course, as Susan pointed out, the other half of religions argue that this is the point at which Saul is doomed to all eternity, because he decided to go to a different god, essentially. Yes, Carrie.
Well, it's just a perfect example of him trying to go around God. If God doesn't give you help in something, there's a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to get on your face
and try to
repent,
figure out what you can
walk
do
in repentance so that he will listen to you. And he'd known for a long time God wasn't listening, and he knew the reason why.
Yes, he did know the reason why.
And
full well.
God didn't help him, and he still went around.
Okay. Let's move forward. So, of course, he asks, his servants say, yes, there's a wounded Endor, which is a short trip from Gilboa, as you can tell, across Jezreel Valley. It's like about a 5-mile trek. It's not that far. You can do it in the evening, especially if you're on, most likely, horses. So he travels down there. Oh, I just lost my place here. Of course, he disguises himself, because she would know what Saul looks like. Well, she might. Not everybody gets to meet the king, but she might identify his garb or his clothing or some identifying marker to indicate who he is. Conceals himself, makes her not understand who she is, who he is. Of course, asks her to perform a seance or bring somebody up. Your Bibles may argue what she actually is. Mine said she was a necromancer, which is slightly different than a medium, not by a whole lot. There are some subtlety differences between the two, either of which Deuteronomy chapter 18 is quite explicit about getting rid of such people. They're not to be consulted, not to be allowed to live, you must expel them from the land. Expelling doesn't mean you have to execute them, but you must get rid of them. Whether it means you tell them, all right, you have 24 hours to get off our property, so to speak, our property is the outer country borders, or whatever. The point is to get rid of them. They're not allowed to survive or conduct anything in your territory. Yes, Jeff?
Well, just a point on the difference between the words medium and necromancer. It
yes.
depends on whether you think you're talking to the dead or not.
That's true. That's a good point. That's a good point. Necromancer is supposed to be actually talking to dead. Mary?
Do you see any relation to what we're commanded not to do? You know, with sorcery and magic and all this kind of stuff, with what, you know, the modern prophetic movement in Christianity is doing. You know, do you see any kind of similarities there, or?
You know, I don't like stepping on toes. I probably will step on some toes saying this, but my personal opinion, modern prophecy. Prophecy people who go out and say, oh, well, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, this is going to happen, blah, blah, blah. If you don't do this, don't do that. Are in it for personal gain. It's a straight, hey, look at me. I declare it such and such. Thus, you must obey me or the bad things that happen. If bad thing doesn't happen, oh, clearly enough of you obeyed me. It's such a wishy-washy, absurd thing, but it gets that person's name out real quick. I don't know how many of you received emails of, oh, prophecy is such going to happen. Happens, I don't know, how many times a month. You get some bogus emails, or I call it bogus. I apologize for those of you who choose to believe it. That's your business. Get an email that states, this town, God's going to smite these people. I look at it and say, okay, my mind goes straight back to Sodom and Gomorrah. All right, how many people were required to save that town? 10. 10 was all that was required. I look at this, okay, these people are declaring this region's going to be smited. Are there 10 good people in this region? By God's definition of good. Well, considering they discuss regions as, like, size of a state, which to me is a very large region, there are likely to be 10 good people, godly people. Not perfect people, but godly people in that state or that region. That's my personal perspective. I'm not necessarily right, but that's how I look at it. So the people who go out and declare prophecies of, this gets wiped out because of that, and this and that, and this and that. That may be the case, but the most of them I've seen have been self-grandizing, to put one's own name out. No much different than what Tay was mentioning, charlatans, people with fakes. That's my personal opinion, of course. And I don't mean to step on anybody's toes. I apologize if I offended you, but that's my personal opinion. Well, it offends people. Yes, William.
Witchcraft and all of this world, this kingdom, this world of evil spirits, is most definitely is real, and it is tangible, and it is the reason why it is forbidden. The only other case where we have somebody that appeared from the dead was on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Right.
This was a good sense, though, but nonetheless, here were two people from the dead, mm-hmm. Mount Transfiguration,
and
Peter, James, and John was there and saying, oh, my God.
This is happening in front of us. We can see this.
Is this real? Is this a figment of my imagination, or this is Moses and Elijah standing before me? And it was. Mm-hmm. And so while we do have glimpses from the scripture of contacting the dead, we can't, there's something
we're not supposed to.
We're not supposed to. You can find the channel, but if you do, there are consequences. That is, you just go into the world of disobedience, and there's consequences of that, being possessed yourself. There's just consequences, and we're not supposed to dive into that world. But it is real.
I need to keep moving, so very quick comments. Go ahead.
What Samuel did tell him was what he told him a long time ago.
While he was alive.
Yeah, that when he did the sacrifice that he was not supposed to because he didn't wait for Samuel, he told him then what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he just reiterated, you disturbed me and this, it's going to happen to you tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Which we'll get into that, hopefully. Yes, Carmel.
I look at prophetic issues different from what this is calling like necromancy and mediums. I would compare that in our current day to psychics and, anything like that where they're seeking a spirit or some kind of spirit information. Prophetic, whether it's a real prophet or the prophets, and that's a whole different issue. I would think that, and there are some that are out there for self-aggrandizing, but I do think there are some out there also that have God's, spirit in or God's words with them. And a lot of that comes back in looking at the attitude from which they put forth their prophetic messages. So, but we certainly deal with in the psychic realm and in all these other witches and everything else that are still around today.
Yes,
I think that is comparable to what they were dealing with back here.
That's a fair comment. Let me move on forward a little bit. I apologize for cutting any more of you off. So moving forward, Saul swore by God's name she will not be held accountable for it, and which is actually a fair assessment because he's the one who's commanding her to do so. If she refuses, of course, she can be killed for it, but that's not to say that would be a bad thing. but that's okay. So she made her choice, and she obeyed. She asked who to bring up. To bring up Samuel. This is where it gets interesting. Look at what she does. So the woman saw Samuel, and she cried out with a loud voice. She spoke to Saul, saying, "Why have you deceived me? For you are Saul." How did she know the guy sitting next to her was Saul while she's looking at Samuel? Did Samuel tell her? Not recorded. Did Saul say, "Oh, look, it was me"? No, that's not recorded. Something was unique about this particular scenario. I don't believe that she quite knew what she was doing at this point. I believe God was influencing this moment. Now, I believe that, my personal opinion, because of what this particular spirit being says. Yes.
Yeah, Amy. Clark's commentary on this, you know, he basically says, you know, I think he goes to that same position, and the reason he goes to that position is because he points out that she hadn't started doing whatever she normally would do, whatever process or sacrifices or little rituals she would do to begin. She hadn't had a chance to start doing that yet. Mm-hmm. So she sees this being come up.
She screams.
She knows
something's wrong.
She screamed. She knew there was something different this time about what's happening.
And that's a very common assessment at this point. In most religious backgrounds, but as far as the text itself is concerned, it's a pretty common thing that something was odd about this particular event. Because number one, she screamed out, and she identified who she was talking to, as far as it being Saul was there as king, without anybody telling her it was him. So this being or deity either did something or said something or some event happened with it that caused her to have information that she didn't have before.
I think she was afraid.
Sarah. Oh, right. Of course she was afraid.
Yeah.
Well, right. So something unique occurred to cause that event. The reason I bring that up is because did this demon lie? No. Did this demon tell correctly all the previous points of history?
Yes.
Did this demon correctly tell the future? Did this demon then know the plan of God? So you sure it's a demon?
Okay, good question.
Are you sure it's a demon? Because demons, number one, their expertise is lying. Yes, they can show up as an angel to deceive. They have that ability, the appearance of light. They have that ability. And hear me out. I know that this might be a little irritating to some of you, but hear me out. But the demon knew God's plan. Now that's interesting. Because not even Satan understands God's plan. How is it that a demon would understand God's plan? Makes you question. Unless God had an influence on what was happening here. That God was fulfilling this. Now, you could argue, yeah, it was still a demon. Okay, it could have been. Could also have been an angel. Commanded by God, this is what you will appear to be. You will say this to this individual. And it will be correct. It will not be a lie. I find this interesting. That's one of the reasons why Judaism jumps on this and says, wait a minute. Something is unique about this particular scenario. Because previous encounters of demons have always been liars. Not ones who tell and prophesy the future. So they said something is unique about this particular one. Now that's just my comment on it. You may completely disagree with me. That's perfectly fine and perfectly acceptable. But that's my comment on it. Yes, Jeff.
2 points. In Deuteronomy it says that even if a prophet foretells the future and they tell you to go a different route from what God said in the Torah, you don't believe them.
Right.
So a false prophet can be true.
Right.
But they can lead you in a different direction.
Right.
Second point, to say that this was an Elohim sent by God, sent by, you know, the
Something
Lord.
Something had happened, right?
That would make the serpent at the tree right.
Not necessarily.
Because the reason being is that what was his contention? The contention is that you can be like God. Thus, you don't need to go to God to get the knowledge. You can get it yourself. Where is Saul at? He is going in a route that God said not to go to get knowledge that God wouldn't give him. And thus, what is he getting?
I don't think I completely agree with you on that. But that's okay. We don't have to. First of all, the demon didn't mislead him, or the deity did not mislead him. Didn't tell him any direction that was incorrect. Didn't give him any direction that was wrong or right. Or correction. Intercessor was wrong. And it gave him information that was completely correct. It did not tell Saul what to do. It just gave him the information. It was still under Saul's control whether he wished to flee for his life, which he could have obviously chosen to do. Would it have made a difference? Probably not. God would have killed him later anyway. But he gave him that information. So it wasn't this particular deity didn't mislead Saul in any fashion. As far as getting knowledge outside of God, well, that's the debatable. Is this outside? Did God allow this to occur, or did God not allow this to occur? And that's the debate. That's the question. See, if God allowed it to occur, not saying God's recommending thou shalt all go out and seek mediums and necromancers, nothing of an absurd sort. I'm just saying that a particular event occurred, and something unique about it had occurred. And because of that uniqueness, it appears to me, in my personal opinion, of course, that God is allowing something odd to happen. Yes, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, just in the sense about saying something that's not true, the sense that you're getting knowledge from a source that God told you not to go to is itself a false direction. Because in a sense, you're saying, well, God told you in the Torah this, but really you can get knowledge here after all.
I'll think about that one for a minute. Ellie, your hand up.
That's my point, too. The very fact that this being came up and said, I'm Samuel, not a vision. This isn't a vision like Elijah and Moses. That was a vision. That's something, somebody seeing something. This guy comes up and says, I'm Samuel. And he's giving information. Right there he lied. If an angel had come and said, Samuel's dead in his grave, God sent me to talk to you, that's a different thing. But this guy said he's Samuel. He wasn't Samuel. Samuel's dead in his grave.
I'm not arguing that this is necessarily an angel. I'm arguing that God had some influence in this. And no, he didn't actually say it's Samuel. Saul said that. Go ahead.
On the comment of getting knowledge in a way that God didn't authorize, we have Christmas and Easter.
Right.
People that believe in God celebrate those every year. And yes, I think it's wrong that they do it, but the information that is given out during those days, much of it, not all of it, is true. They talk about the death and resurrection of the Messiah. They talk about the reason why. They talk about the birth. Their timing's all off. But the message of God is still there. There is true information being given out and being received at the wrong time of year, but it's happening.
That's true. Yes, William. Oh, sorry. Susan first.
Say, first of all, the word tells us that he is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living.
Right.
And a bit later on in this, it says that this being, and by the way, the word for familiar spirit, it means like to be like a water bottle. In other words, it's something, a vehicle which is filled with another medium, another quantity or quality of something. And then he says, and today, and furthermore, tomorrow, you and your sons will be with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me that sounds awfully much more, and I'm unpersuaded each way, by the way, but it does sound to me like that is a threat, almost like a demon. You're going to be with
it's
me.
Ominous, it's an ominous threat. I agree.
Exactly.
I have no argument with that.
And my position is with other people who've said, why would God fail to respond to Saul and then respond to him by this means that is forbidden? I mean, that to me is, you've got to get over that question first. Really, that's kind of the issue.
Well, you're bringing the question whether God's responding. I didn't say God was responding. This particular being knew God's plan.
No, you kind of said
Hear me out.
Okay.
This particular knew God's plan. So somehow, this particular being had instruction, had guidance, had commandment, had rules, had something given to it allowing it to understand and reveal God's plan.
Are you saying that it wasn't Samuel, but it?
Oh, no, I'm not arguing Samuel at all.
That it's, you're not saying that it really is Samuel raised up from
the dead. I guess in some theory, even someone could argue it could be, but I'm not arguing
Samuel.
You said
initially that God raises people from the dead.
Oh, right. That was earlier. So that it's not unheard of for God to raise people from the dead. We know that much. So I'm not arguing that this is Samuel. So don't get me wrong. I'm saying that
it's
a being that is likely not Samuel. Now, whether it is an angel or a demon, that is your own personal point of view. All I'm pointing out is that this particular deity, this being, had some foreknowledge of God's plan in him. And of course, he then tells the truth about it. Whether or not you wish to say, well, yes, it's because he was a smart demon. Okay, fine. So argue it's a smart demon. I don't care. It's a unique scenario. Something odd happened here. And because the lady happened to have screamed out, unexpectedly, something really weird happened this particular time versus other times, it implies to me that there is some odd scenario here other than ordinary, you know, mediums talking to whatever they do. I don't care what they do. Other than some typical event that she's accustomed to, something rather unique occurred here that she was not accustomed to. If she wasn't accustomed to it, there's something bigger going on here in this little story than what, oh, Saul just happened to consult a demon. No, I don't think he just happened to consult the demon. I think this demon was either instructed by, given permission told by God, you will curse Saul in this fashion by fulfilling what he is asking. And go ahead and tell him that this is his doom. Because it's going to happen now for sure, because he's consulting you and doing this method. That's my perspective.
What somebody called the charlatan previously. Maybe she was just shocked that she really was suddenly talking to a demonic being. I mean, that's happened to me. I've actually had that happen to me, and it is a shock when that happens.
It could be. Yes, William.
I don't think she was shocked because she had consulted demonic being. That was her lifestyle, consulting demonic being. And so why would she all of a sudden be afraid of this demonic being? That was her world conjuring up demonic spirit. And just like you said, she, in this instance, it was unique in that she shouted out and said, as though the Father said, no, you... You don't have no business bringing this up. It's like she engaged something holy to me. I lean on the side of she engaged something holy and said, and she shook. Demons shake and tremble at the presence of something that they shouldn't have brought up.
Right. That's fair. A couple more hands up. I got to end this, unfortunately. Way too early.
Good point to shriek, you know, because someone who's familiar with darkness and everything, when the light comes, you know what I mean, they're... Yeah, exactly. Just like when Yeshua, you know, cast it out, demon, they shriek and they said, don't cast us into there or whatever. So that's a good point, actually.
Yeah. And to address Jeff's earlier point, which it took me a while to think about this for a moment, so hear me out for just a second. Regarding God allowing something which is unholy to occur in order to get a point across or make an accomplishment. Well, the same argument has been brought up many, many times regarding Pharaoh, the same concept of Pharaoh hardening his heart. And that God's interaction, doing something which caused, in many's point of view, caused the death of a large group of people, thus God is doing something which is ungood, I won't say evil, but it's ungood, in order to cause the death of others. Well, and we've discussed that before, that the hardening of a heart accomplished nothing more than to bring Pharaoh to his baseness, the basic instinct of who Pharaoh always was. And my personal perspective on the same argument we just brought up is it applies here as well in the same fashion. Because allowing this event to occur in Saul, and it brings Saul to the base person he always was. If nothing happened, this is the key. If Saul goes to this lady and says, please conjure up such and such, and nothing happened, then he didn't consult a necromancer. He wouldn't have consulted a medium. He consulted a fraud. Then that sin won't be held against him. And that's a problem. Because in this case, God can hold this sin against Saul as well, an add-on. To bring, because it shows Saul's baseness, that he is so desperate to get others to tell him what truth is. And of course, his whole history has been based upon others telling him what was right and wrong. He needs that. So, all right, Saul, how low will you go? Will you go so low that you will consult the demons to get in guidance? I think God may have easily allowed that. By all means, Saul, do it. Will you do it? And of course, Saul said, yes. I will obey whatever it takes to get me guidance from somewhere else other than God. I think that's actually, it is conceivable that God would have allowed this to occur then based on that idea or concept. You don't have to agree with me. I'm not arguing you have to agree with me. I'm just saying that something was odd here. I apologize for taking over. I would love to go through the rest of this chapter, which I'm going to have to postpone because there's a whole lot more here than just this. Let's see, I will mention one. I'll mention one thing, which is the only shred of, I won't say decency, but tolerableness that Saul did. He didn't run. How many of you would say, even if God was coming to you and said, I'm going to kill you tomorrow if you go over here. Are you going to go over there? You run!
Where are you going to run?
And exactly, Saul, his sons, his whole, at least his three of his sons, would all going to be killed tomorrow, and or the following day. And he knew that. The only shred of half acceptableness that I can give him is that he didn't tell his sons, let's get out of here. He went anyway. I won't say it's redeeming quality. The man has murdered innocent priests. He's done horrible things in his life. I don't believe he'll be held any less destructiveness in his future, but I'll give him at least that much. Of course, if he run, as I mentioned before, he'd probably been killed by a rock. Whatever. God, if God wanted him dead, he was going to be dead anyway. It's probably what Saul was figuring out too. But I'll give him the one little shred of point. He didn't actually run. I apologize for taking you so far over time. It's been a fun discussion. It's always interesting. That's the whole point of having a good discussion. You don't have to agree, just that it's an interesting thing to talk about. Have a wonderful rest of the Shabbat.